Hello there and welcome. Today is Thursday, December the 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Yahoo announces another massive security breach.
The usernames, email addresses, dates of birth.
Another devastating blow to civilians trapped in Aleppo, Syria. Climate scientists are taking dramatic measures to protect their data ahead of worries over Donald Trump policies.
If it is done, the consequences would be so grave that it justifies taking this action now.
Also ahead, Hollywood news, including an update on actress Shannen Doherty's fight against breast cancer. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, a plan to evacuate civilians and rebels from Aleppo, Syria, was delayed on Wednesday as a ceasefire in the battered city broke down, with the resumption of fighting in the last remaining rebel-held areas. Dr. Kula Sawa is the CEO of the U.S. branch of the relief group Union of Medical Care and Relief Organizations. She tells International Edition Sarah Williams what she knows about the situation of remaining civilians trapped in Aleppo.
I mean, imagine you have about, you know, I know it's between 80 and less than 100,000 people that are trapped now in few kilometers. They're saying between, I think, around 2 kilometers. But so I say a few kilometers, they're trapped in an area that are being heavily bombed at this point. Basically, they're waiting for the moment of death. And there's no swift action that is occurring. And the negotiation was actually choosing a resolution. They came to a resolution between two crimes against humanity, either to, you know, destroy the whole city on the top of the people, and they are in there, or to force evacuate them off the city just to save their lives, but also to force them out of their own homes. And even the second resolution that they came about last night has not been applied.
Do you know, is it clear why the evacuation did not take place? I believe the various countries are accusing the other of being responsible.
Yes. I mean, there have been a lot of accusations. However, I mean, you will definitely hear different reports because, you know, you have different parties involved and every party wants to make sure that they're getting it out in the way they are involved.
Is there any kind of medical treatment left there in Aleppo?
Oh, that's a really tough question. Actually, if there is, it's going to be very scarce. We know that the doctors there are really struggling with the few medical supplies that they have left with them. Trying to work in a little bit safer areas. And I heard one of the doctors was saying, of course, I cannot disclose names, that we won't leave until we make sure that the people leave safely. Because if people need us inside here, we want to make sure there's a doctor that could respond to their call. Situation is beyond imagination.
And I'm sure the people left have anything.
Nothing at all. No. I mean, it's total besiege. They have been under total besiege for over 100 days. So if they had any at one point, now it's the situation. You know, what we're hearing right now is basically, you know, the people are trapped in a very small area. Imagine you have 100,000 people and a very few kilometers of area with scarce food, probably scarce medications, if there's any left, and no fuel, no electricity, no clean water. I don't know how to describe it, but I could just say that they are keeping those people just to face the moment of death, basically, if it's going to continue like that, and they don't find a resolution within the next 24 hours or so.
I don't know what any of the chances would be if any kind of resolution could be found at this point.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, it is very much a lot of political sides are involved, and it's really hard when you have many parties are involved to get a resolution. And really, we as humanitarian actors, we cannot resolve issues like that. It is basically this is the responsibility of the international community, and they need to take action before even it's too late. I mean, it's already too late, but even further to be late to keep those people just to die there and no action taken.
That's Dr. Kula Sawa, the CEO of the U.S. branch of the relief group Union of Medical Care and Relief Organizations. Here are some of the other stories we're following at voanews.com. U.S. troops to arrive in Europe in January to reassure allies. Obama says it's just the beginning for my brother's keeper program. Trump team is disavowing a survey seeking names of climate experts. And Twitter rolls out live streaming. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues now. While there continues to be mixed reaction to President-elect Donald Trump's pick for Secretary of State, with some praising ExxonMobil chair and chief executive officer Rex Tillerson, others expressing concern about his deep ties with Russia. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Steve Herman reports from the State Department.
The president-elect, in a statement, declared oil company boss Rex Tillerson an excellent choice for Secretary of State based on his tenacity, broad experience, and deep understanding of geopolitics.
He has obviously superb management leadership experience, and so I think that's going to be useful. But he doesn't have policy experience.
Among the first international figures to praise Trump's choice was the leader of OPEC, the 13-nation oil cartel, who deemed Tillerson more than overqualified.
There is a very thin line between oil, geopolitics, and diplomacy.
The nominee may find walking that thin line challenging when he faces U.S. senators for his confirmation hearing.
There are both Republicans and Democrats asking questions about Mr. Tillerson's potential conflicts of interest, about his long and close relationship with Vladimir Putin in Russia, and about his ability to balance the demands of being a diplomat and fighting for America's interests with his long experience leading an oil and gas company, which has very different interests and priorities.
Tillerson has been a critic of U.S. sanctions against Russia, which have hurt ExxonMobil's business.
We would expect that the nominee, Mr. Tillerson, would in fact seek to loosen sanctions on Russia.
Russia is alleged to have attempted to interfere in the recent U.S. presidential election, which Trump won. Lawmakers and others also have ongoing concerns about Moscow's military activities in Ukraine and Syria.
Any sense of warming relations with Russia that people perceive as based on self-interest is going to create issues for the United States in its diplomacy.
There is concern at the State Department whenever there is a change of leadership, but veteran diplomats do not foresee a large exodus of career staff.
They just hope that the new secretary sees them as professionals, uses them as professionals, and draws on the expertise that they have. So nobody's planning on abandoning ship.
The incumbent Secretary of State, John Kerry, has congratulated Tillerson on his nomination and pledged the State Department's full support for a smooth transition. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the State Department.
Well, meanwhile, the United States Federal Reserve is raising a key interest rate in response to a strengthening U.S. economy and expectations of higher inflation. And it foresees three more rate hikes in 2017. Fed Chair Janet Yellen explained that it will mean modestly higher rates on some loans.
Our decision to raise rates is should certainly be understood as a reflection of the confidence we have in the progress the economy has made and our judgment that that progress will continue and the economy has proven to be remarkably resilient. So it is a vote of confidence in the economy.
Yellen says it was a decision that was anticipated and will have little impact on market rates. Turning now to what's been trending on social media, we're joined by Michael Lippin. Well, Michael, there is lots of chatter about this topic. Not one usually that's much talk on social media.
Hi, Laurie. Well, that's right. It's one of those days because the Fed, as we've already heard, raised its key interest rate today by 0.25%, only its second rate increase in 8 years. Now, an economics professor at the University of Michigan, Justin Wolfers, put this into perspective on his Twitter feed, which has more than 100,000 followers. He tweeted, "My daughter is now 7 years old, and she's never seen the Fed set interest rates as high as 1%. Wolfers also wrote, the Fed raised its rates from super low to merely very low. Not much to argue about here. It's still really, really cheap to borrow money in the U.S., and he's right about that. The U.S. news site Politico tweeted a story about how the rate hike could affect the incoming Trump administration. Its headline goes like this: Trump wants to light a rocket under the U.S. economy. Yellen just started hiding some of the fuel. Well, in that article, Politico explains that the Fed expects Trump to introduce significant stimulus to the economy in 2017, and it says the Fed is ready to put the brakes on that if necessary. Politico says that could further unsettle a relationship that already saw the president-elect repeatedly criticize the central bank chairwoman on the campaign trail.
Wow. Okay. Well, there's another Trump-related topic getting some attention on social media today. What was that?
Well, that's right, Lori. It was Trump's Wednesday meeting with leaders of major U.S. tech companies at his Trump Tower office in New York. Donald Trump's tech summit was one of the top trends on Facebook today. Trump met with senior executives of Apple, Alphabet, Facebook, and Oracle, amongst others, and an ABC News article about that meeting got a lot of Facebook users commenting. Among the critics of Trump was Terry Bingham. He said, "Trump's going to try to bully those tech companies, and when that won't work, he'll bribe them, and more of our tax dollars will be going toward corporate welfare. Hashtag Don the Con is a crook." Among the supporters of Trump was a guy named Billy Parker who said, "Trump is working hard and early. Let's get this money from working with the tech companies, stop hating, and let this process play out."
Well, one U.S. tech company that doesn't appear to have been a part of the summit was Yahoo, and they're also getting some attention on social media today for all the wrong reasons.
Well, you could say that, Lori. It's because Yahoo revealed late Wednesday that a hacking incident from 2013 compromised data from 1 billion Yahoo user accounts. Yes, that's 1 billion in what could be one of the biggest hacking attacks ever. For the first several hours after the news broke, Yahoo hadn't said anything about that case on its social media platforms, but Twitter users were definitely weighing in. One of them, Thomas Escobar, wrote this: "Yahoo, over a billion accounts hacked. Probably how my identity got stolen. Sign me up for a class action lawsuit." And then there was a tweet from a user named Kimmy who said, "Shaking my head, I used to love Yahoo years ago, and then started having issues. Thank goodness I ditched them."
What?
So a lot of Twitter users having fun at Yahoo's expense, but of course we don't really know how serious this is and if actual damage could be done to internet users. Lori?
All right, Michael, thank you so much. And you can follow him at Michael_Lippin. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, Yahoo did reveal, as we mentioned Wednesday, that it believes hackers stole data from more than 1 billion user accounts in August of 2013 in what is thought to be the largest data breach at an email provider. The Sunnyvale, California company was also home to what's now most likely the second largest hack in history, one that exposed 500 million Yahoo accounts. Joining me now to talk more about this enormous breach, Jamil Jaffer, currently the Vice President for Strategy and Business Development at IronNet Cybersecurity. Thank you so much for joining us yet again for the subject of cyber hacking. How did this one happen?
So it looks like Yahoo learned about this in November. Law enforcement came to them and said, "Look, we have this third party claim they have data files from you." So they looked into it, and what they determined was that in August 2013, somebody, an unknown person, stole or unknown group of actors stole 1 billion data associated with 1 billion user accounts. Distinct from the report we heard in September, where we learned about 500 million user accounts that were compromised. Important to note here that what was lost was usernames, email addresses, dates of birth, but not bank account information or credit card information. They did have hashed passwords, but no clear text passwords.
Any idea who's responsible?
Well, you know, unlike the thing that was announced in September, which related to a theft that took place in late 2014, so a year after this hack took place, in that case, Yahoo talked about a state-sponsored attacker. They haven't mentioned anything like that here. So we know that the 2014 attack involving 500 or hack involving 500 million accounts what involved a state-sponsored attacker, according to Yahoo. This one we don't know, this 1 billion records.
Well, the company said that, like you said, the passwords may have also been stolen from affected accounts. But how would this impact users who may be reusing their Yahoo passwords on other online accounts?
None of the passwords were compromised in the sense that they were clear text. They were hashed passwords. Could you undo the hashes? Potentially, but they weren't clear text passwords. you know, if you're able to steal somebody's password with clear text, you know what it is. You see it. It's right there in front of you. You can go reuse it. A hash password is one that's essentially been encrypted. It's been mixed up. You don't know what the actual password is using an algorithm, what's known as the MD5 algorithm in this case. In the passwords that were stolen in the 500 million user case, they're encrypted using a technique called bcrypt.
So how likely are we to continue seeing things like this happening, or are we actually getting better at preventing more of them from happening?
Well, look, I mean, all companies are taking steps to protect themselves, you know. A lot of companies just need to get the basics right, the basic hygiene, and get that right. And then the companies that are better off and that have done that to protect themselves still need to engage in advanced activities to protect themselves, because as the hack, you know, become more advanced, as the attackers become more advanced, threat becomes more advanced, and so they need to keep up. And so companies need to continue to evolve every day their defenses against these attackers, because the attackers are evolving, companies need to evolve too.
All right. Well, we appreciate your perspective as always. Jamil Jaffer, currently Vice President for Strategy and Business Development at IronNet Cybersecurity. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on the Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all, from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Well, scientists with the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration are reporting Arctic ice is melting at an astonishing rate. It comes as climate scientists feel a cloud of uncertainty when it comes to dealing with global warming. Joining me now is University of St. Thomas climate scientist Dr. John Abraham. Thanks for being with us. So the more rapid Arctic ice melt, is this something new?
No, this isn't something new, but it's being manifest in a way that is pretty shocking. We know the Arctic is warming. In fact, the Arctic's warming about twice as fast as the rest of the planet. And it's been warming fast for a long time. But what we're seeing this year is really remarkable warmth that has done tremendous things to the ice. We now have less ice at this time of year than ever on record. And what this just reminds us is that climate change is real. It's happening. We're seeing it. We can document it. And things that we've expected to have happen, like Arctic warming, are happening just as fast or faster than we had originally planned.
Is this or is this not settled science as far as man's interference in climate change?
This is as settled science as laws of gravity. I mean, there is no longer any debate amongst any reputable climate scientist that humans are causing climate change. In fact, this wasn't invented by Al Gore. This was discovered in the 1820s. We've known about human-induced climate change for over 100 years. And just as we know influenza is caused by a virus, we know that humans are causing climate change. This is as well understood as almost anything in all of science.
How concerned are climate scientists that you know about some of the people that the president-elect is choosing for his cabinet that would have roles in how the U.S. deals with climate change? People that that are, I guess you would call them skeptics.
No, I wouldn't call them skeptics. Skeptics refers to a healthy skepticism of facts. You want to be shown the facts. But then when the evidence is put in front of you, you'll be objective and accept it. So I think a kind word would be a contrarian or a denier of science. I mean, they are not skeptics. I'm a skeptic. All my colleagues are skeptics, and it's a disservice to skeptics to call these people by that term. But you asked, how do my colleagues and I, what's our outlook now? My response is we have just come off of 7.5 years of fantastic development in renewable clean energy, a revolution in the United States supply of energy and our position in the new energy economy. Our emissions are down. Our costs are down. And while we want to give an incoming administration the benefit of the doubt, what we're seeing is people are being tapped to head the transition plan or head organizations that deal with climate change who have in the past wanted to dismantle those very same organizations. In the past, they've been stark deniers of the reality of climate change. So while we would like to give the benefit of the doubt, there's been nothing shown that suggests that this incoming president will take climate change seriously. And we don't really have 4 years to lose. This would be, in the words of one of my colleagues, an unmitigated disaster for the environment.
I read a report, and I'm wondering if it's accurate, that said that climate scientists across the country are scrambling to archive data in case an incoming administration would try to erase any evidence of all of this. Is that true?
It sounds crazy. It sounds unbelievable, but it actually is true. And the issue is this. We have a lot of data that it records our Earth's climate. It includes data from computer programs. It includes sea level data, tree ring data, ice core data, data that go back years, decades, and even centuries. And we need to know the past if we want to know where we're going to go in the future. Right now, a lot of that data is maintained by the United States government. And if the United States government decides it does not want to invest in the maintenance of that data could be lost. And we have a saying in science that a measurement that you've lost is like a measurement you never took. So what scientists are really doing, and this is happening as we speak, they're trying to back up this data, put it on non-governmental servers, and make extra copies so that if funding is eliminated for this archiving, we'll still be able to have the data elsewhere. And you're right, it is a scramble. I'd say there is no hard evidence that will be done by the administration. But if it is done, the consequences would be so grave that it justifies taking this action now.
All right. Well, we appreciate your perspective. Thanks for being with us. University of St. Thomas climate scientist Dr. John Abraham. Turn now to Hollywood news, starting with actress Shannon Doherty and her continued battle with breast cancer. Joining me now to talk more about it, Nicole Moschella. She's the content editor with the website rare.us. Tell us about what's been happening.
Her husband is Kurt Isorinko. They just celebrated their fifth anniversary together, and he is suing her management company, Tanner Mainstain Glenn and Johnson, because he says that this cancer diagnosis that she has ruined their sex life. And she actually was just awarded about $15 million because she also sued her former management company, saying that because they let her health care lapse, she was not able to get this diagnosis sooner, and then now it's become an even bigger issue. She had to have a mastectomy, she's doing chemo and radiation. So it's been kind of a mess in her life, a tragedy in her life, really, and they want somebody to pay for it.
Do we know anything about how she is as far as her health and where that stands as far as her recovery?
Yeah, I follow her on social media. She's been very big on social media documenting her cancer journey, and she's giving a real raw look at it, like everything from cutting her hair off. The process of doing that with her best friend and her mother over the summer, she cut all of her hair off herself before chemo could take it, right down to her, this gut-wrenching photo of her in a hospital bed. But she's so positive, so her spirits are good, but she has not really come forward and said, my cancer is gone or anything like that. She just kind of says that here was a chemo day and chemo sucks. And she did do the chemo and the radiation.
Okay. Well, we, of course, wish her all the best and praying for her speedy recovery. And then we've got some news about this popular daytime TV show that was pretty much, I believe, started by Barbara Walters. And now she's coming out not so happy with the way it's sort of evolving, or as she might say, devolving.
Exactly, yes. So Page Six ran a story this week, and I did a little bit on it myself. And they said that sources close to Barbara Walters are saying that she feels like the integrity of The View has been completely ruined by executives at ABC. She said that she thinks that the show eventually someday will only be remembered for the on-air bickering and the drama that goes on behind the stage between the women that are on The View. They're all very strong personalities with Joy Behar, Jedediah Villa, Whoopi Goldberg, and they do. They get into it on set, and it makes for great television, but it's not what Barbara Walters dreamed of. And what sources said is that she thinks that instead of focusing on smart, educated women and strong talent, they've cast uninformed child actors, which I think is a dig at Raven Simone and Candace Cameron Bure, who have now since left The View, but are both former child stars that were on the roundtable at one point.
Has ABC responded at all?
They did respond. They said that despite all of these crazy rumors, their relationship with Barbara Walters is better than ever. She's happy. They're happy. But she was invited to be on a post-election recap of The View in November, and she decided not to do it and went on vacation with her daughter instead. So I don't know if things with Barbara Walters are really great for ABC, but they say that they are.
All right. Well, we appreciate your perspective. Thanks so much for being with us. Nicole Michella, she's the content editor with the website rare.us. You've been listening to International Edition. That will do it for today's show. But you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
At the recent Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, or OSCE, ministerial meeting, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry reaffirmed that we advance the security and prosperity of our citizens when we advance the timeless principles that are at the heart of the OSCE. These principles include democratic governance and the rule of law, anti-corruption, respect for the sovereignty and territorial integrity of every state, the dignity of each individual, and an unflinching stand against anti-Semitism, anti-Muslim, anti-Christian bigotry and intolerance of any kind. The ongoing conflict in eastern Ukraine and Russian occupation of Crimea are of particular concern. It is in the interest of all to end the suffering and the stalemate, and that is why the United States continues to support France and Germany in their efforts as mediators within the Normandy format. The United States strongly backs the trilateral contact group of the OSCE, Ukraine, and Russia, and renews its call for the full implementation of the Minsk agreements. At the same time, Russia's ongoing aggression in eastern Ukraine and occupation of Crimea must not obscure the longer-term challenge that Ukraine is tackling, the task of building a healthy democracy. And the fight against corruption and for reform is what the people of Ukraine rightly recognize as the decisive battlefield. Their determination to live in a democratic society governed by the rule of law, said Secretary Kerry, demands our support. There are other conflicts in the OSCE that still fester, including between Armenia and Azerbaijan, and in Moldova and Georgia. In too many places in the OSCE region, there has been a rise of authoritarian thinking accompanied by backsliding on human rights, restrictions on independent media, a spike in acts of intolerance and hate crimes. Bigotry, repression, and the silencing of dissent cannot become the new normal for any of us, said Secretary Kerry. Every chip away at the fundamentals of freedom is actually an ugly building block in the road to tyranny. A free press, religious liberty, political openness, transparency in governance, and a flourishing civil society are the signs of a thriving nation. When people and institutions are denied these rights, the OSCE will continue to speak out.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
is